Hello, and welcome to History Extra, formerly the BBC History Magazine, on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story is The Secret History of the Odyssey, featuring cyclops, lotus eaters, and goddesses that turn men into pigs. The Odyssey reads like a fantastical adventure story, yet, writes Daisy Dunn, Homer's epic poem, now a Hollywood blockbuster, offers a fascinating lens onto the reality of life in Bronze Age Greece. In the late 19th century, an archaeologist was excavating a grave in the Peloponnese, 75 miles southwest of Athens, when he made an extraordinary discovery. At his feet lay a high-stemmed goblet of hammered gold, with a pair of mottled birds atop its two handles. Heinrich Schliemann looked at the vessel admiringly before realizing why it was familiar. Nestor, an elderly ally of Odysseus, was described as owning a very beautiful goblet, just like it in Homer's Iliad. There the cup was described as footed and gold, with four handles and two golden doves were feeding on each. But what was a couple of handles where art was concerned? Nestor's cup, supposed Schliemann, had finally been found. Schliemann, a wealthy Prussian businessman, was notoriously overzealous in his quest to find evidence of Homer's world. His excavations, the now-accepted site of ancient Troy near Hellespont, involved digging aggressively through layers of civilization in search of the lost city of King Priam. Many of the deepest treasures that Schliemann believed to have come from the age of Homer, in fact, proved to be still more ancient. The gold goblet with doves was eventually dated to about four centuries before Nestor was supposed to have lived. But Schliemann was not wrong to believe that aspects of what Homer described in his Iliad and Odyssey might be reflected in the archaeological record. It is tantalizing to think that, for all their flights of fancy, the Homeric epics do contain true reminiscences and memories of the historical past. While the poems should be enjoyed as poems first and foremost, they are also valuable sources to the historian, who may find them a powerful lens onto late Bronze Age Greece. Strikingly old. The composition of the Homeric epics was slow and involving. Conceived in an age before writing in Greece, the poems are commonly believed to have evolved orally over several generations before being set down in writing in the late 8th century BC, or just after. What makes them so striking is that the events they describe are far older than this. It would not be inaccurate to describe the two works as the poetic equivalent of historical novels. The stories are consciously set about 400 years before the poems were completed. Homer's first audience would have been aware of this. For all that their storylines were broadly fictional, the poems were based around a world informed by history and archaeology. In his efforts to describe a truly heroic age in Greece's past, Homer, working in the 8th century BC, looked to the accomplishments of the Mycenaeans, a late Bronze Age people who took their name from the Greek city of Mycenae, located north of Argos in the northeastern Peloponnese. Mycenae, where Nestor's cup was found, was well known to Homer. In his poems, it is the kingdom ruled by Agamemnon who led Odysseus and his men against Troy. It is described as rich in gold and well-built, with broad streets. Historically, it was all those things. Its limestone fortification, walls rising more than 10 meters in place, with a 4.5-meter lintel supporting the pair of lionesses above its famous Lion Gate. The Mycenaeans established important centers across Peloponnese at many cities, and maintained cultural contacts as far afield as Egypt and Syria. They were at the height of their power in roughly 1350 to 1200 BC, a few generations before the presumed date of Homer's Trojan War. Golden Walls. In the Odyssey, both Odysseus and his son Telemachus encounter palatial societies that loosely resemble those created by the Mycenaeans. Odysseus's final journey before he reaches his home on Ithaca takes him to Scheria. Golden were the walls that enclosed the elegant home within, sang Homer of the royal palace there, and silver were the doorposts that stood on the bronze threshold. Outside were orchards that were forever in fruit. It seems to be something magical about this people. It is perhaps a reflection of how the Greeks of Homer's time felt about their own ancestors. Odysseus, king of Ithaca, himself owns a palace, a faded palace, but a palace nevertheless. He describes his island as a rugged but kind nurse to men. Its relative rusticity may be accounted for by the fact that it sat on the mere fringes of the Mycenaean world. Travelers and scholars have long noted a discrepancy between Homer's description of Odysseus's Ithaca and the geography of modern Ithaca. The island Odysseus calls home is described in the poem as low-lying. A convincing argument has been made for identifying it rather with Palaeke, a peninsula of Cephalonia, which may have been a separate island in millennia past. It lay at some distance from the sparkling palaces of the Peloponnese. Odysseus has been away from Ithaca for nearly 20 years, 10 at Troy and 10 traveling, when Telemachus sets off in search of information about him. In the third book of the Odyssey, Athena, his father's long-term mentor, guides him to Pylos. The comparative grandeur of this city is immediately apparent to the youngster. It was no accident that, in Homer's epics, Pylos is the kingdom of Nestor, owner of the gold cup, for historically it was, like Mycenae, an exquisitely rich and developed center. The palace built at Pylos around 1300 BC had a footprint of nearly 6,000 square meters and featured courtyards, a vast columned hall with a central hearth, and running water supplied by an early form of aqueduct. A single storeroom within the complex contained nearly 3,000 cups. There was also a terracotta bath built into a grand bathroom. Homer perhaps had this bathtub in mind when he described Nestor's daughter Polycaste bathing Telemachus during his visit in the Odyssey. The tub is certainly wondrous, for, as Homer says, he comes out of the bath looking like the immortal gods in his physique. By Homer's time, this and the other Mycenaean palaces and city walls were but ruins, many of them badly charred. Soon after the putative date of the fall of Troy, conventionally placed in ancient times at 1184-83 BC, the Mycenaeans entered a period of decline that culminated in the destruction of their illustrious centers. Homer's tale of the Trojan War has sometimes been read as an allegory for the real-life devastation and decline suffered by the inhabitants of Troy and other palatial societies at the end of the Bronze Age. The Trojan Citadel was built and rebuilt many times, but one of its grandest iterations was savaged by fire around 1180 BC. The palace at Pylos was engulfed at a similar date. Mycenae was ravaged not much later, and the site of Thebes ceased to be inhabited in the same period. The destruction of the palaces, whether by man, natural disaster, or a combination of both, presaged centuries of change in which the population size of the Peloponnese nearly halved, the art of writing was lost, and the quality of art and grave goods declined. The Homeric epics belong to the end of this period, when Greece was growing richer again and a new form of alphabetic writing was developed, borrowed and adapted from the Phoenicians. For many of the people of Homer's time, nevertheless, visiting the sites of Mycenae and Pylos, with their splendid ruins, would be like visiting a burnt-out Hampton Court palace if we had known only villages of Wattle and Daub. The parallel may be extreme, but the archaeology of the Late Bronze Age, including the Grand Citadel at Troy, certainly inspired awe in Homer. The sheer scale and magnificence of the architecture could only be explained if the men of that time were stronger than their descendants and more important to the gods. And so Homer presents the wide and very beautiful wall surrounding Troy as the handiwork of Poseidon, god of the sea. Odysseus's ally is said to lift a boulder so heavy that more than two men of Homer's own time would need to carry it. Speculation about what the architects of the Bronze Age societies must have been like also helped to shape Homer's characters. The protagonists of his epics are presented as a heroic race, closer to the gods than their modern counterparts, both physically and temperamentally. Odysseus and his men even eat like gods, feasting regularly on meat, while the real-life 8th century BC Greeks survived predominantly on vegetables, fish and beans, with meat reserved mainly for religious festival. Bones of the dead. Studying the graves of their ancestors provided the Greeks with further confirmation of their heroism. Some of the wealthiest Mycenaeans were laid to rest in beehive-shaped tombs covered by high mounds. The best preserved of these tombs, the so-called Treasury of Arteris, had a dome of some 40 feet high, and was named optimistically after the father of Agamemnon. Analysis of the bones of the dead interred in Bronze Age grave circles at Mycenae confirms that they ate a lot of meat and were on average at least 3 inches taller than their descendants. Weapons and armor found in these graves bear a strong resemblance to those described in Homer's poems. Although iron was the metal most commonly used in warfare, in Homer's time, the poet evoked the heroic age of the past by giving his soldiers bronze spearheads, swords, and daggers. Fragments of boar tusk have been found in the Mycenae graves, suggesting some historical basis for Odysseus's helmet, which Homer describes as having tightly set rows of white tusks of the bright-toothed wild boar lining its outside. A large repository of clay writing tablets, well preserved at Pylos as a result of being burned by the fires as in a kiln, reveals a historical foundation for many of the jobs described in the Odyssey. What was written in Linear B on the Bronze Age tablets as wanax or leader became in Homer's Greek annex, a position claimed by Telemachus on Ithaca as well as by Agamemnon. Women listed on the tablets as flour grinders find their modern counterparts as grinders of wheat and barley, the morrow of men at mills in the Odyssey. The poem even contains a reference to such tablets as these in what was either an intended tribute to the literacy of the early age or an accidental slip made in the new age of writing in Greece. Indeed, just occasionally, Homer gave himself away, and traces of his age infringe upon the historical setting of his narrative. The Cyclops encountered by Odysseus on his voyage home, for example, are characterized as uncivilized because they lack public assemblies for lawmaking. The 8th and 7th century BC witnessed the establishment of the Greek polis, city-state, an institution in which laws and assemblies would play an important part. There is also reference in the epics to Gorgon shield devices, cult statues, and temples, which do not appear in any number until Homer's time. The development of the epics, in fact, coincided with the development of hero cults, some of them dedicated to Homer's own characters. Meat-eating heroes. Homer's revival of the worlds of the Late Bronze Age was not always determined or conscious. The use of words such as annex for leader or lord may have been intentional, but other words and verb forms have clearly been preserved by being recited down the long ages of the poem's composition. It is probable that some of the evocations of late Bronze Age society were similarly memories and products of hearsay passed down through the ages rather than mere historical staging. The result was a melting pot of old and new that has proven utterly irresistible to readers and historians alike. Homer's Odyssey has earned a particular place in our hearts because it is often the poem we encounter first in one form or another. Stories of Odysseus's adventures on his long journey home, his encounters with the Cyclops, his enjoyment of the siren song, his passages have been extracted and retold. In many ways, that journey encapsulated the final voyage away from an antique age of meat-eating heroes, monumental palaces, and emotionally invested gods towards stark Iron Age modernity and the promise it held. Much has been written about the Bronze Age collapse, but the story of the homecoming of the last hero, a product of a long-lost era, resonates beyond all others. In returning to Ithaca, Odysseus not only closed a chapter in his life, he opened a door onto the future of the Greek world. Daisy Dunn is a classicist and the author of books, including Homer, a Lady Bird Expert book, 2019. You're listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. In our next story, Fanny Bullock Workman, Trailblazer in the Himalayas. Mountaineering was still in its infancy when Fanny Bullock Workman took to the peaks of Europe and Asia. Daniel Light salutes a pioneer who was also a groundbreaking geographer and one of the first women to lecture at the Sorbonne in Paris. "This is very dangerous," said Matthias Zubrigen. He stopped and found what footing he could. "We won't be going down today." Fanny and Hunter Workman, roped together with Zubrigen, stopped too. Midway through their third season in the Himalayas, this was the first time they had seen their Swiss guide thrown off balance. The ice had been fine that morning, firm and fast. Zubrigen had cut neat little steps as he led the couple and their porter to the 19,260-foot crest of an avalanche-scored ice wall. Now as they descended, the furnace heat of the midday sun had turned their steps to mush. With camp still more than 1,000 feet below, they were in trouble. Fanny knew there was no question of staying put, crowded together, the mountainside melting beneath them. So after a little food and a short rest, they resumed their descent. Zurbriggen had read the danger well. They had gone a few more steps when their porter, Giuseppe Muller, slipped and fell. For Fanny, such a moment of danger was nothing new. She had long known mountains as places of high drama. Born to a wealthy family in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1859, she had finished her education in the European cities of Paris and Dresden, drawing on visits to the Alps as inspiration for short stories set among its snowy peaks. Returning home in 1879, Fanny found society life stifling. She escaped by hiking in the hills or by disappearing into the books of English mountaineers such as Alfred Wills and Edward Whymper. Her marriage in 1881 to Dr. William Hunter Workman was such an ideal match. 12 years her senior, Hunter introduced her to climbing as the pair spent their summers exploring New Hampshire's White Mountains. Fitter and more ambitious than her husband, Fanny came to lead these expeditions. In 1889, the Workmans moved to Dresden with their 5-year-old daughter, Rachel. Later that year, a son, Siegfried, was born. Leaving their children in the care of others, Fanny and Hunter explored Europe on their safety bicycles, a revolutionary design employing wheels of equal sizes. In 1891, they cycled to the Alps and climbed Mont Blanc. In 1892, it was the Matterhorn. Then the following year, days after their return from a tour in Italy, tragedy struck. Siegfried contracted influenza. Pneumonia took hold. Within weeks, he was gone. Grief proved a driving force. Following a period of mourning, Fanny and Hunter went farther, wider, and higher. They cycled through Spain and Algeria, writing books about their experiences. Fanny saw off bandits with her revolver, wild dogs with her whip. Fanny hoped that by combining lavish description with robust scientific observation, her books would appeal to a broad readership. But they enjoyed only moderate success, neither substantive enough for the geographical establishment nor frivolous enough for the masses. In part because she craved a bigger audience, her thoughts turned east. Late in 1897, she and Hunter made port at Colombo, Sri Lanka. In the months that followed, they meandered 4,000 miles north through India until the summer heat on the plains chased them up into the foothills of the Himalayas. At the hill station of Darjeeling, Fanny planned her first Himalayan mountaineering expedition. It was not a success. The workmen were forced to turn back after just 4 days. Some of the 60 local porters and guides she employed deserted. Others, lacking confidence in the enterprise, burned their boots. Effective partnership. Fanny was back next summer with Zurbriggen as her guide. The Swiss had climbed in the Karakoram, a range at the western end of the Himalayas, on the Conway expedition of 1892. He knew the mountains, and how better to manage those who called them home. With their big personalities, Fanny and Zurbriggen inevitably clashed. He would go off on long tirades as to what a great guide he was, Fanny wrote in her journals. Zurbriggen was a fool about taking care of himself, she added, and an ass in most respects. But their partnership was effective. In 1899, Zurbriggen led Fanny to a new women's world altitude record on a peak she christened the Siegfried Horn. 4 days later, she broke her own record on the newly appointed Mount Bullock Workman. Another week, she broke it again, braving a snowstorm to reach the 2,997-foot summit of Kozer Grunge. Fanny became the first female mountaineer known to have climbed higher than 20,000 feet. Focused and resolute when climbing, Fanny was meticulous in her preparations and seemingly impervious to the worst excesses of altitude sickness. She kept a cool head even in the most precarious of situations, never more than when, high on the ice wall in 1902, she watched Giuseppe Muller slide away down the mountainside. Fanny knew that if Hunter, next on the rope, failed to arrest the porter's fall, she would take the weight of both men. Zurbriggen above her already had his ice axe buried deep in the ice, the rope looped twice around it, but there was no guarantee his anchor would hold. It did not come to that. Hunter, seeing Mullen slip, took hold of a small ice projection in one hand, tightened his grip on the rope with the other. As the porter's weight came onto him, Hunter's stance held. Time froze as Muller searched for a footing. Then, to Hunter's relief, the rope slackened. Muller was saved, only to be subjected to a torrent of abuse from Zurbriggen, who scolded the porter for his carelessness. "We went on," wrote Fanny, "but the feeling of danger was tremendous. Getting down took 5 hours. Zurbriggen called it," noted Hunter, "the most difficult call, the lowest point on a ridge between two peaks, he had ever made." Fanny broke her women's altitude record again the following year, twice in one day. Then in 1906, she ascended a 22,740-foot peak in the Nun Kun Massif on the border of Kashmir. She had reached a height more significant than she ever knew, the highest Himalayan summit known to have been trodden by a woman or man. She named it Pinnacle Peak, fitting for the apex of her climbing career. The Special Leader. Fanny was more than just a mountaineer. She was a serious geographer who, from her final Himalayan experience, produced a map so accomplished that even the high minds of the Royal Geographical Society were impressed. She was a campaigner pictured on the last expedition holding a newspaper with the headline, "Votes for Women." And she was always careful to identify herself as the initiator and special leader of her expeditions, aided by her husband's valuable cooperation. Sadly, Fanny did not extend the same equanimity to the couple's indigenous porters and guides. They were bawling and unendurable, she wrote of those who, without the warm clothes, snowshoes, or full stomachs taken for granted by their bosses, carried heavy loads to 2,000 feet. On one occasion, when some of the local men refused to march, Hunter pelted them with stones. However, it's worth noting that, as a woman, she faced unique challenges as she sought to command the confidence of those in her charge. And for all the problems she faced, plenty of her own making, she was one of the most preeminent explorers of her day in the Himalayas. She was widely honored the first American woman to lecture at the Sorbonne in Paris, and one of the first to be made a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. As a teenager, Fanny imagined mountain summits as places where anything was possible. Climbing rewarded her dreaming, empowered her to rise above the world as it was. In the Himalayas, leading pioneering expeditions to record-breaking heights, she found something closer to the world as she would have liked it to be. Daniel Light is a climber and the author of The White Ladder, Triumph and Tragedy at the Dawn of Mountaineering, published by One World 2024. You're listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona, formerly the BBC History Magazine. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Classical Royal British Music by D-Lo Sound. Remember, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode.